You're Kappa? You're here because of the dead doctor?
Yes.
I read something about sessions on Mondays. Tell me about this Monday group.
There's five patients in the group.
Like five cuckoos?
No. Four neurotics of varying degrees and one killer.
Welcome to Now Playing's bonus review of Color of Night.
To deny red is to deny emotion.
Oh, yeah.
As you know, that can be very dangerous.
A Podbean backer review chosen by Ole Horvi.
Nobody appreciates you the way that I do.
Hosted by Arnie.
Black, emotional, whole, unattractive me!
Stuart.
You are the goddamn enemy. You and this whole tower of psychobabble.
And Jacob.
You are one sinister piece of work.
This podcast will contain detailed plot spoilers and harsh language.
I don't have to tell you shit.
That's right, you have to tell me
shit. Don't fucking tell me anything. Hey. Well, I want somebody tell me some fucking truth.
Listener discretion is advised.
I think we should get started now.
Tonight, we're discussing The Color of Night, starring Bruce Willis, Jane March, Ruben Blades, Leslie Ann Warren, Brad Dourif, Lance Henriksen, Kevin J. O'Connor. So many people we have covered in other horror movies. Directed by Richard Rush. This is the Now Playing co-host who will do things to you that make you not want to be a woman anymore, Arnie.
And Stuart.
This is Jacob. And guys, I know this is a sponsored podcast. I'm not sure who it is, but I do feel like it's the same people who sponsored episodes of Sesame Street. Like, this film is definitely brought to us by the letter F, the number 7, and the color red.
F7, isn't that a, like, increased brightness key?
I don't know. I just an F is the grade I give this one.
Yeah, it's amazing. Thank you for showing up, July patrons. You got to be wondering, what the hell are they doing reviewing this movie that didn't seem like a very big hit back in 1994? I think it made $20 million, but Bruce Willis was much more talking about Pulp Fiction that year than he was about this.
I can't believe this film came out the same year as Pulp Fiction.
He ought to be glad.
The Tale of Two Willises.
Well, this is a new patron who's been listening to us since 2011 and a longtime supporter. He pledged for us to do Color of Night.
Why this movie? He wanted to make us laugh?
His name is Ole Horvi. He said he's been itching to pick a movie for us to review for a while, and he couldn't figure out which one to do.
Did he throw a dart at a board?
He'd never even heard of this movie until a couple months ago.
Oh, okay.
He was preparing to listen to a podcast about erotic thriller movies, and so he started watching just a bunch of them released during the 80s and 90s, and he says, pretty much all of those movies were what I expected them to be until I watched The Color of Night.
Good answer. It's supposed to be Basic Instinct, right? Right? And yet, Sharon Stone opening her crotch is not the same thing as Richie.
I mean, come on, we're going to see Bruce's Willis in this film.
We definitely do, in some cuts.
In the cut I saw, you see the head there.
What he said was, when the movie started, he thought it was annoying and he just wanted to turn it off, until Scott Bakula is killed by what looks like a tiny person. And then at that moment, something clicked and it became hysterical, and he couldn't believe he'd never heard of this movie before. He felt like this was a hidden gem in a so bad it's good kind of way, and by the end of the movie, he had no words.
Thank God, because, yeah, I saw this on a bad movie night. Maybe listeners know that that was something I like to do, get people together and watch really terrible films. And this was definitely one of those nights, late into the night. It might have even been the climax, as it were. But yes, I remember thinking, oh God, this movie is just beyond belief.
And when he asked us to do it, I had seen this film because up until the early 2000s, when he started doing direct-to-video utter shit, I saw every Bruce Willis movie. Again, I pulled out those old Leonard Maltin and Roger Ebert guides, looked up Bruce Willis, and just went through them chronologically. And when he said Color of Night, I'm like, the one on the boat with Sarah Jessica Parker?
Striking Distance. Nope. The one after that one.
Yeah. So then I remembered this movie. It came flooding back to me like a repressed memory of all the press around it, all the discussion about Willis's weenie. I'm going to refer to it from here on out as Bruno. So all the talk about Bruno being in the film.
I had no idea. I had never heard of this film. I didn't know there was all this press going on around this thing. I could see why, though, after watching it.
Yeah, it really was the age of adult entertainment coming to major movie theaters. Basic Instinct had opened the floodgates, and we had Sliver, and
that's not all it opened.
Yeah, well, we were having major stars talking about showing their most private parts. That just wasn't something you could see in a movie theater back at that time. So, yes, I do remember the hype around this movie when it came out in August 1994, but did you go see it? I didn't know anyone that went and saw it.
No, I saw all of his movies, but I didn't see them all in theaters. And in fact, during my college years, I saw very few of them in theaters. But the moment they hit video, I was renting it. But this one, I mean, I was 20 years old and I was promised lots of hot, steamy sex. I didn't have to go into the back room of the video store that day. I just rented Color of Night, thinking that it would be a twofer, Bruce Willis and erotic.
And the lead story might have been Bruce Willis's Willis, but I do think that there was another talking point to the release of this film. It was the return of Richard Rush.
Who?
Yeah, he had made a big splash in 1980, was nominated for Best Director and Best Screenwriter for the movie The Stuntman.
In the Academy Awards.
Yes, absolutely.
Not the Razzies.
Correct.
Like, this guy did something good.
Well, I won't go that far. Some people will call The Stuntman a work of genius. I saw it in film school. Somebody recommended it to me, and I said, what the fuck? I didn't understand it. The same person that recommended it also said The Ninth Configuration was their favorite movie, and I kind of think of them.
Oh, yeah, that's a warning sign.
Yeah, it's kind of the same experience. Steve Railsback is a criminal who decides to hide out on a movie set, posing as a stuntman, and Peter O'Toole is the director on that film who keeps trying to put this man in jeopardy, and it just gets more and more metaphorical and bizarre.
That sounds fun.
Some people tell you it's a parable about man's relationship to God. I didn't see that. I just saw like a crazy movie with a really annoying theme song that kept playing again and again and again. Kind of like Darren Aronofsky's Mother.
I liked Mother, so I'm going to have to check this out. I might like it.
It's absurd pretension that some people hail as genius, and the Academy Awards said genius, and then Richard Rush was gone. It took him 14 years to come back to make another film, and it was Color of Night.
Wow.
Well, he did do a commentary for this film.
Wow.
This film, for being what Ole called a hidden gem, is popular enough to have four cuts out in circulation.
Yeah, I read this after I saw, I think, the longest cut, almost 2.5 hours. I was very upset that I could have watched a shorter version of it.
I want the longer one. I saw the, I think what I saw was the theatrical and thus R-rated and no Willis is Willis.
Oh, yeah. I think I saw the director's cut, it's called.
Well, here's what it is there's the theatrical cut, R-rated, what you saw in theaters. Then there's the international theatrical cut.
Where they got some full frontal.
Yeah, they can definitely get away with more than that. We know what international is code for.
We saw Bruno in that one.
Sure.
But I'll tell the whole story because I honestly find the making of this movie more interesting than the movie in many ways. There's the director's R-rated cut. And then there's the director's unrated cut. So
he's got two cuts?
Again, with or without Bruno.
Okay, so I saw the director's unrated cut.
Yes. And you talked about Richard Rush, and he hadn't had anything done for a while, but he was still bouncing around Hollywood, working on his next project, working with Carol Co. And there was a name, just because of the topic of this movie, when the very first credit to pop up says, Andrew G. Vagina Presents.
What?
Didn't you guys notice Andrew G. V-A-J-N-A?
Vajna.
Yeah, I didn't pronounce it that way.
Yeah, no. He's a known producer. Like, he's got cred. Like, that's not code for vajayjay.
No, I know. And when I was listening to the commentary, it's pronounced Vanya. But I'm sorry, I'm watching this movie, and in a font larger than anybody else's name, I think okay. I see vagina.
I won't judge you for that. Your mind should be on vagina.
I mean, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if this film did that.
Well, he was head of Carol Co., and Richard Rush had written what he considered the best script he'd ever done. Air America.
Oh, okay. Air America, I have seen that. I don't remember a whole lot about it, though.
I saw it back in the day. You know, I was a Robert Downey fan, and...
It's with Mel Gibson, right?
Yep. But not his version. He was promised that he could direct it, and he had signed Sean Connery and Kevin Costner.
Okay.
Which sounds like a very different film than the comedic, sarcastic Robert Downey Jr. Mel Gibson film we got. But while he was out scouting locations, Vanya brought in other people and are like, the script is too good for Rush. We're going to make it with other people. Gave it to others who rewrote it, cut ties with everything that Rush had done. Rush got a paycheck for the script and was blackballed out of the project.
Yeah, that sounds like just about everybody that wrote a great script for Hollywood. They just, yeah, they lose.
But to make it up to him, Vanya offered him another job. Now, I don't know that I would take this. You know, if somebody fucks you over that badly, do you then go and take the job that they're offering you at all?
I don't know how bad he needed money, but it must have been really bad judging from this movie.
He says, I got this script, Color of Night. Bruce Willis is already attached. Why is Bruce Willis attached? Why would Bruce Willis do this movie?
Yeah, how did Bruce Willis read, like, Tarantino's Pulp Fiction and go, oh yeah, definitely, I need to be in this groundbreaking film that's going to propel indie movies, and then read this and go, oh yeah, I got to also do this one too.
I mean, I think it's obvious. Obviously, Jane March is a lovely woman, and, you know, that had to be a thought.
She wasn't hired yet. Only Bruce was hired.
Okay.
Bruce needs to fire his agent that talked him into doing this.
Well... Do you fire the head of the William Morris Agency? Because that is co-producing this with Vanya. The head of William Morris said to Bruce, Bruce, I need you to do this. And so Bruce went, all right, I'll do it. You don't say no to that level of juice, even if you're Bruce. So they had Willis, they had a script, but they told Rush, do what you want with the script. Rewrite it, whatever.
Whatever, indeed. That is the directive. Whatever.
They said, if you rewrite it, we'll pay you for the rewrite, too. So he rewrote it and worked with Willis.
So do you think, like, the first script is really good? And he's like, well, I'm going to get an extra paycheck if I rewrite it. So he, like, just turned it into this?
He had a brother who was a psychologist.
I don't think anything in here is based on real psychology.
In his brother's group therapy session, it turned out there was a woman who was secretly sleeping with every other person in group therapy, but each person thought they were the only one.
Mm.
And so he decided that was an interesting enough story. He sat with his brother to make sure everything was sound psychologically as from a therapist's perspective.
His brother needs to lose his license. He should not be practicing if this is what he approved.
We're talking about Bruce Willis or Richard Rush?
Richard Rush. So I guess Dr. Rush broke HIPAA laws and told about this promiscuous group therapy member. And Richard Rush was like, that would make a great movie. Let's put it in this erotic, psychological thriller and make this film. Then problem number one came, Bruce Willis.
I mean, the script is problem number one.
You know what? I feel like I don't know what it was in its origin, but I do feel like Billy Ray, I see his name on the script, and he's a known script doctor. He's done movies of all varying kind of quality, everything from Shattered Glass to the recent Richard Jewell movie, and I doubt he turned in this. I feel like there might have been something to the original movie that wasn't this.
He did a commentary.
Oh, okay. All right.
And yeah, it was a bunch of this was changed and it wasn't super interesting. I actually really liked Rush's commentary a lot more.
I bet.
Because Rush was telling tales out of school, whereas the writer didn't know.
I don't think Rush worked again, right? This is this last foray in Hollywood. This killed him.
It does seem like it killed him off. It almost literally killed him. I mean, legitimately, he almost died making this film.
Wow.
So during the production, Bruce Willis decided he was in control of everything. He started casting people without talking to Rush. He had complete approval of casting. Rush was able to find Jane March and had some input. And then during filming, Bruce Willis is giving people acting instruction instead of Rush. And Rush is like, this movie is incoherent. And he had to take these people aside and say, I know what Bruce is telling you, but here's what you have to be doing in the scene.
This sounds exactly like what people talk about Hudson Hawk was. A brilliant script that just got dismantled by an egomaniacal actor.
But Bruce loved Rush. Loved, loved, loved him. Rush was doing a very good job at Subterfuge. Bruce said to Rush, I want you to make all my movies.
And I do too.
Yeah, because he gets to be in charge.
And it was actually begun, Die Hard 3, directed by Richard Rush.
Oh my God. That's amazing. Okay. So when did it all go wrong? I guess when the first cut of the film came in?
I mean, Bruce Willis, apparently.
I mean, so many things went wrong. I'll talk about some of them when we get to them. But the biggest stuff happened in post-production. Rush thought he had final cut. And it turned out Vanya had in the contract that if Vanya wanted, he could make his own cut. And then they would test both movies and see which would test better. And whichever one tested better is what would go out. And so Vanya had people make a two-hour cut of this film.
What I saw.
Compared to Rush's two-hour, 20-minute cut of this film.
Mm-hmm.
Not even counting then both had to go before the MPAA and they had to cut out Bruno and some other nudity and stuff.
And so who won?
Vanya got higher scores.
I mean, by like fractions of points, right? I can't imagine either cut. This is going to be saved.
So Vanya won and Rush was like, fine, you're putting that movie out. I'm Alan Smithy. I am taking my name off of this movie.
Smart move.
Yeah, why didn't he do that?
Unless you let my version be the international version and the video version. And Vanya knew Alan Smithy was a death knell. He was like, well, we're doing day and date international. Can't give you that, but you can have video. And Rush was like, you know, that's the version most people are going to see anyway, because you know this movie's going to tank, right?
He knew it was bad.
He said to Vanya, you know critics are going to slaughter your cut of this film, right? And Vanya's like, critics only make up 5% of the box office. I don't care what they say.
Did Rush think his extra 20 minutes was going to save the film?
Yeah, that's what's curious, is that he's blaming a cut of the film and not everything.
Like, it's the whole premise of the film that's the problem. That's the starting point of the problems.
What he said was that after this movie was out, and he was just trashed by every critic out there, he didn't name names, but he contacted three major critics and asked them, would you please review my cut of the film?
Wow, he really believed in his cut. Okay.
It makes me want to see this 20 minutes that I missed.
I think it's just more boobs, right?
No, there's a lot more. There's a lot more. I mean, in many ways, it can be seen as a different film. It's rearranging. There's extra scenes. There's...
Okay, so there's things moved around and all that. It's not just deleted scenes.
There's so much incoherence in my cut.
Yes.
I felt like the cut I saw was incoherent, but okay.
I'll say right now, whatever I say of this film, if you want to understand what's going on,
nope.
Rush's cut is better.
Okay.
And he said that those three major critics gave him three rave reviews on the video version.
He paid them.
And you know what? He never said those were published. So maybe they were like being polite. Like they sent him a letter.
Yeah, they didn't have to commit it to a public record. So they're like, yeah, it's great.
But for the longest time, I mean, because it was the cut on video, the cut on Laserdisc, I know what I saw the first time was the unrated director's cut, because the theatrical cut has never been released until very recently, because people are clamoring for this two Blu-ray set of Color of Night.
Who's clamoring? Again, there is no audience that wants this.
I'll just go ahead and put it out there. The way that I saw this movie this time was my library had a copy streaming. So
I'm shocked your library's open. They're like, quarantine? Nah, we're open if you want the Color of Night.
Anyone who wants the Color of Night can get COVID. That's their attitude. But yes, it is a two Blu-ray set with Rush commenting on his cut and the writer commenting on Vanya's cut. And it's certainly something else no matter what cut you see. But yeah, you think about the time. Basic Instinct was really just like a more explicit Fatal Attraction too, right? I mean...
I see Basic Instinct as very much an attempt to be Alfred Hitchcock. And I don't know, I'd have to go back to Fatal Attraction. I only saw it once in theaters in 1987, but I don't remember it being as Hitchcockian.
To me, I just saw them both as sexual thrillers where the woman you're sleeping with is a very dangerous person, maybe. And so there might be, you know, murder going on. But the difference was Basic Instinct, A, brought in some girl-on-girl action.
Yes.
This has a little bit of that.
Not in Stewart's cut.
Oh, I know where that would go. Okay.
And B, it spent so much more time in the bedroom.
Again, in my cut, it feels like there's a lot of time in the bedroom.
Oh, okay. See, I didn't feel like I had enough.
Oh, boy. Time in the swimming pool.
Yeah, well.
Time everywhere.
Oh, no. I know. We'll get to it.
Yeah, so, but I started watching them all because I liked seeing celebrities nude, sure. So, this, I'd heard you saw Bruno, and I was curious, you know?
That is the, as incomprehensible as this film is, that is the only time I rewound, and I'm like, did I just see his Bruno? I gotta know.
Yeah, and I this movie won a lot of Razzie nominations, and it won Worst Picture of 1994 against On Deadly Ground and The Specialist, even. North, another Bruce Willis movie.
Oh, 1994, I feel like he got punished a lot because he's such a groundbreaking film with Pulp Fiction. Like, everything else coming out this year is going to be crap.
He was barely in North, and it was inoffensive.
Go read that Roger Ebert review.
But Maxim Magazine did a ranking of like the best sex scenes in film history. And apparently this has it. Maybe in the unrated cut.
What?
Yeah. If you're a Maxim reader, this was the movie to get off to. But yeah, I was watching them all. Sliver and...
Bound. I mean, yeah, there was a lot.
Oh, Bound was great. I loved Bound.
Well, Arnie, you saw all the cuts. You get to give the plot then. Tell us what happens in Color of Night. I know.
I'm seeing red.
Yeah.
Or not. There's the plot.
Oh, God. Do you have any idea how hard this was to write?
Just be brief.
You know how hard it was to understand?
Yeah, well, we'll get into it. You know, just give us the surface. Just try to give people a sense of the crazy.
Bruce Willis plays Manhattan psychologist Dr. Bill Kappa. When one of Bill's patients commits suicide in front of him, the trauma is so great, he goes colorblind.
I'm sorry, just the memory of that scene. It's okay, all right.
Can't wait to talk about it.
But the colorblindness does not matter at all in this movie, except he can't wear matching socks. Traumatized and depressed, Bill flies to Los Angeles to visit his old college classmate, Dr. Bob Moore, played by Scott Bakula. Bob is doing well, making a lot of money, but he has a crazy amount of security at his house. He confides in Bill that he thinks someone in his group therapy class is trying to kill him. Then Bob ends up dead, stabbed to death. Police Detective Martinez, played by Ruben Blades, encourages Bill to take over the Monday night group therapy sessions and use his psychology skills to figure out who the murderer is.
There are so many constitutional violations from this cop. It's it is
amazing. I want them to break them all. Break them all. Do it.
Martinez says he'll fuck Miranda up the ass.
Like, I don't have a warrant, but just let me in. Come on.
The suspects are obsessive compulsive Clark, played by Brad Dourif.
Chucky.
And Wormwood.
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah, what was he, Charlie in that, I believe? And let's not forget Graveyard Shift. I mean, we've reviewed a lot of Brad Dourif.
I'm just trying to stick to where he's a crazy. I guess he's crazy in Graveyard Shift.
Nymphomaniac and kleptomaniac Sandra, played by Leslie Ann Warren.
Miss Scarlet.
Tortured artist Casey, played by Kevin J. O'Connor.
Literally tortured.
Who, of course, was Swan in Lord of Illusions.
Yeah, I know. The Scott Bakula connections.
I mean, Kevin J. O'Connor, I've said this every time we've reviewed him. His forehead is so large, I only can think of him with, like, that third eye coming out of it in Lord of Illusions.
Did Scott Bakula get to cast some people, too? Like, Bruce Willis is like, yeah, bring your friends, whoever you want. You did a movie with that person, bring him in.
Well, Sinbad isn't here from Necessary Roughness.
So. It would be even greater if he was.
Depressed ex-cop Clark, played by Lance Henriksen.
Aw, poor Bishop.
This was post-Mangler 2, I think, so this is a step up. No, I guess this was pre-Mangler 2. And troubled, sexually confused, drug addict Richie. When Bill goes house to house to interview the group members, yes, one of them's a murderer. Let me do house calls.
Ding dong. Did you do it?
While doing this, he gets in a minor car accident with a beautiful girl named Rose, played by Jane March. Rose pursues Bill, and the two have a steamy affair. It seems everyone has a motive as well as a psychotic impulse. Sandra tried to stab Clark, Richie physically attacked Casey, and more. But it turns out that every group member, including Sandra, is sleeping with the same woman named Bonnie. And Bonnie uses her real name, Rose, when she's sleeping with Bill. So, follow me on this, and I'll go slow. Rose, who's wearing a red wig and using the name Bonnie when sleeping with everybody else in the group.
Because he won't be able to see her hair?
But that never comes up. Oh, I'll wait till we get into the details. It doesn't matter.
Well, Rose had a younger brother named Richie and an older brother named Dale. And they were all abandoned. Their parents just left. So Dale was the father figure. Richie was in therapy and molested by his child psychologist, who was not Scott Bakula, a different guy.
Yeah, we never even see him, at least in my cut.
No, he's dead. He's dead before this movie begins. He killed himself after molesting Richie, or possibly he was murdered.
Right.
And Richie was being molested by his older brother, Dale. So Richie commits suicide. The real Richie is dead. Dale, wanting somebody else to rape, starts calling Rose Richie and makes her dress like Richie.
Is that why he did this?
Yes.
Yes. By the way, Richie was 12. Like, just all of this is just so fucking lurid. It's just so depraved.
Yeah, in this movie, Rose slash Richie is supposed to be a late teenager.
Yeah, 16, I think they say.
Well, Richie would have been 16. I think Rose is like 18, 19.
But the Richie she's playing is, yeah, a teenager.
Yeah. So the abuse at the hand of her older brother caused Rose to develop multiple personality disorder, as she actually became the Richie who's attending group therapy.
And all this is psychologist approved. This is all stuff that happens in real life.
Yeah, I believe it.
Well, the subjects of sexual abuse do often have multiple personality disorder in order to help have a defense, you know, escape from the molestation. A different person comes forward that can handle it more. I mean, there's something here. But the Rose personality is sleeping with everybody in the group and Bill for reasons. And it turned out she was sleeping with Bob. But I'm pretty sure Bob realized Rose was Richie. So Dale killed Bob to keep the secret that Dale was molesting Rose.
Sure.
Do I need to say that again? Because it's fucking confusing.
No, we got to go through the movie. Just keep moving on. People are going to start dying and it's fun.
And Dale killed Casey, the artist, because he thought Casey's paintings of Rose would link Rose to Richie. So when Bill figures out Rose is Richie, Rose tries to kill herself, but Bill stops her. Then Dale attacks and tries to kill Bill. Instead, Rose kills Dale with a nail gun, saving Bill's life.
Yeah, people, there's a nail gun involved in all this.
Yeah, because he owns a giant warehouse, so it makes it more fun.
He's a furniture builder.
Oh, okay.
Is that what he was doing? Okay.
I mean, these are massive pieces of furniture. This for King Kong? What are you talking about? Maybe he made those straps.
Rose tries to kill herself again, but Bill talks her out of it as credits roll.
Woo, and as they start, there it is, all that you need to know. Hollywood Pictures, that was the slogan. If it's the Sphinx, it stinks.
And you told me that way back when. I think the first time you told me that is when Eddie Murphy did The Distinguished Gentleman.
Ooh. I'll have to do a deep dive and see if they ever made a good movie. They probably did, by accident, somewhere in their line. But they were very unsuccessful and are no more.
They are the more mature-ish version of Disney, right? They were a Disney sub-brand.
They were supposed to be the blockbusters. Touchstone was for the adults, and Disney was for kids.
Wait, this was supposed to be a blockbuster?
Yeah. They had the Rocketeer. They had all the big moneymakers.
Rocketeer was, yeah, that wasn't a blockbuster either. You know, I always think it's really brave of the film, and I think...
Brave. I love that description for this movie. This movie is brave.
I love, maybe I've been influenced by movies like Star Wars and The Hidden Fortress, where you're just thrown into the action and you're kind of lost and you figure it out. Like, that's something I really enjoy in films. But this one, when I see a woman with like a magic music box that has like multiple lipstick dispensed out of it.
And, a carousel of lipstick.
And then she's like just putting it all over her face and she puts a gun in her mouth. And like, I don't know. All I can think of is Yakov Smirnoff. Like, in America, you put gun in your mouth to blow you away. In Russia, you put gun in your mouth to blow the gun. Yeah. Like, because she sucks it off.
She is giving the gun head. And with lipstick smeared like Bozo the Clown, she's alone. She's not putting on a show. The show she's putting on before the gun is really, really hysterical. She's like throwing sofa pillows and screaming.
No idea what's going on.
It's awesome. And the punchline is, when we cut to Bruce Willis, the first line of dialogue is, "We all do it," which just makes me want to see Willis applying lipstick all over his face madly in a mirror.
When this character, Michelle, goes to see Bill, played by Bruce Willis, she's like screaming. I'm like, oh, is this her boyfriend, husband? They're having a fight. Then she jumps out the window. Like, I had no idea he was a shrink until that said later when he gets to LA. Again, no idea what was going on in this scene, except a crazy woman jumps out a window.
It's a real unnatural fit, right? Bruce Willis, therapist, just doesn't, it doesn't flow. It doesn't.
Sixth Sense?
I mean, that would come later, but I don't even think of him. I mean, I think of him, spoiler alert, I think of him as a ghost in that movie. I don't think of him as a therapist. So the vibe is off right from the get-go.
And we've reviewed this actress who played Michelle before. And again, to me, I always think her performances are a little askew because I knew her very, very well as Rosalie, the mentally challenged girlfriend of Benny, the mentally challenged clerk on LA Law.
Oh, yeah.
And she went on to play like an emotionally disturbed person with a similar performance for 8 years on ER.
You mean awful and bad? She's able to get a job for 8 years with this kind of acting.
She was also on Twin Peaks. I think that was where we talked about her. She was Lucy's sister for an episode.
That's right, yes.
That seems about right for her.
So anytime I see her, I'm always just thinking her performance is off kilter anyway. So the lipstick thing seems right in line, but it does seem like she's calmed down. She does not pull the trigger. She goes and sees her therapist, and Bruce, he's an asshole here. He's like, I can't keep track of who you're mad at this week.
Again, I thought they were like lovers. I had no idea he was a shrink because this does not seem like a therapy session.
It's not something you should say to your patients.
Right. Yeah. You don't need to run out the window. You need to push him out the window. Like, he's a terrible therapist. It's bad for him. He has rightfully, for the rest of this movie, he will have colorblind guilt over the bad advice that he gives. He makes the phrase, we all try to look at our lives through a keyhole, and that becomes some kind of visual motif throughout this movie.
He says that so many times in the director's cut.
I gotta ask you, Arnie, because you listen to all these commentary tracks. Was Rush super proud of this shot? Like, this is such a pretentious, artsy shot that makes no sense. When Michelle jumps out the window and falls to her death.
You keep saying jumps out. I want to just point out Bugs Bunny. She just runs through the glass.
The glass breaks so easily.
I think she actually runs across the air and then stops and looks down and realizes there's gravity and that's why she falls. But there is this shot. She falls and all this blood's coming out of her. And they do this reverse shot from like the street where it's all of a sudden clear. And you could like, first of all, she should have burst open. But does he say anything about this shot? It is such a dumb shot for this.
We're looking up at her body as if we're underneath her and the pavement is glass.
He doesn't speak about this shot because he's too busy complaining about the production basis here. But what we're getting with the swirl and the desaturation is this is the moment Bruce Willis's character Billy goes colorblind. The blood turns gray, and we're supposed to get from that he's colorblind. And if you don't, in the very next scene in the director's cut, he's literally at an eye doctor getting diagnosed as colorblind.
Oh, Stuart didn't get to see that where the dots are like flashing different colors.
That test is real, the colorblind dot test, but
yeah, no, I know that, but the fact that they're having the colors like flash on and off, like I get it when the blood turned gray, it's stupid and they're just gonna double down on that.
Well, here I'm just gonna throw out, not that I wanna throw a life raft to this movie, it can sink, it can drown, I'm perfectly fine, but obviously the influence I'm seeing very clearly, and many thrillers through the 90s were guilty of this, was they were trying to do a Hitchcock. Specifically, it's Vertigo.
Yes.
If you see that movie, Jimmy Stewart's fear of heights impairs his ability to pursue this woman later, and I think that they were trying to give Bruce a similar handicap.
Yeah, but what's so weird is that handicap never comes into play as far as I could tell. Bill goes to see his therapist, and his, I guess the therapist has a therapist, or maybe it's just a therapist friend.
Well, most therapists are in therapy.
And this therapist tells him to deny Red is to deny emotion. I don't know what kind of crockpot philosophy this is, but okay, so...
Which is dangerous, by the way. Like he adds, that's very dangerous. Don't deny Red.
So we're supposed to take it as Bill is closed off emotionally because he seems very passionate when he gets to LA and hooks up with Rose. Like, he should be able to see Red immediately. There's so much emotion going on.
I honestly thought that the twist of this movie would be because Rose wears a red wig when she's pretending to be Bonnie, that Billy would see her, and because he can't see Red, would just immediately notice it.
I was waiting for that moment. I thought that was, once I realized that Bonnie was also Rose, I'm like, okay, so this is how he's gonna find out, because he'll see brown hair and no lipstick, so it looks like Rose. Nope, that does not happen in this movie.
See, I thought you guys in the longer cut could tell me what I missed about this setup.
This whole Red stuff doesn't matter.
It's very clear they're trying to link his guilt to this psychosomatic problem, and that in going through what he's about to, it'll allow him to be a therapist again, and it will allow him to see Red again.
Yeah, I mean, he's going to see Red by the end of this film, and it is hilarious.
But he is being sued for this, and properly so, by the family of the dead woman.
They don't even know the half of it, of the things he said to her. I mean, Jesus.
Yeah, this was on audio cassette. Ooh. So, in the middle of the lawsuit, he closes his practice and decides to go visit Scott Bakula. And I've said this before, I love Scott Bakula. He is an affable presence in everything he's in. I couldn't remember who was in this movie when I saw his name pretty high up in the opening credits. I'm like, yeah, good. I want him to hang out with Scott Bakula a long time. Bakula is not in this movie nearly enough.
I mean, are you dying to read Way to Go? That sounds ridiculous.
Bakula does feel like the LA version of Bruce Willis. Like, if Bruce Willis is New York, then yeah, he's like the sunnier, more fun, riding bike trails kind of therapist.
Less successful.
Yes.
I mean, in this movie, he's more successful, but in real life.
He's running the strangest group therapy session I've ever seen. I mean, normally you want to bring people together that have a shared experience so that they're like, we can bond, we can learn from each other. This is like clashing types of problems.
Yeah, and Nympho was someone with gender identity issues, with a painter, with an obsessive compulsive, like, bad therapy all around in this film. I can't believe there was a therapist that read this script and gave it the okay.
My thought was that this was family therapy, like this was Knives Out, like maybe these were all siblings and Lance Henriksen was the dad, you know? That was the only explanation I could have for why you'd have all these different crazies in one room. And instead, no, this just happens to be the people who are free Monday night and troubled.
And Scott Bakula knows one of them is trying to kill him. Instead of disbanding the group, he's bringing in Willis to like ferret it out, because he knows that Bruce is a better diagnoser. He can figure these things out. He can't figure out Richie's problem, so I don't know why they're putting this all on him and being a great therapist.
Well, they keep saying that Bill is kind of psychic when it comes to his psychology.
No. Bill is a psychic when it comes to masochist. That is the line.
That is a line, but it comes from both Bob and later on a cop saying for him to use this psychic type skill to figure out who's the killer. I think that's why Bob brings Bill. Can we have more B names here, please? A movie that stars Bruce playing Bill with his friend Bob.
There's a Buck. Bonnie.
Yeah, he's so great at figuring everything out. He's like calling people nutcases and rats. I'm just like, yeah, I don't think he's really got this therapy thing down. He made his last patient run out of a window. Like, just stop him. Just, no, this is bad.
Question, Richie, we're supposed to believe that that is a male. I know they say gender identity issues. I'm like, oh, it's obviously a female that wants to be male.
Yeah, I wondered if it took any amount of time for you to, or even if you were supposed to understand, we're supposed to think Richie is gay and not trans.
What I saw immediately was I figured trans.
Yeah, that's where I went.
It wasn't until the second time we see Richie after we've seen Rose for the first time that I'm like, oh, that has to be the movie secret.
Yeah, I figured that one out kind of late. I got the Bonnie Rose thing pretty early on, but the whole Richie twist, we'll talk about it.
Yeah, I think it helps that I know who Jane March is.
Who is she? I don't know who this is.
She was acclaimed. She was an it girl. She was going to have a big career. She did this independent film called The Lover that was highly metaphorical and erotic. I mean, she took her clothes off in that, and a lot of critics pinned their hopes.
Yeah, I feel like she did a lot of Skinamax before this.
She was going to be Helena Bonham Carter. Like, the feeling was like that was where she was headed without Tim Burton. And then she did Color of Night, and it was like, whoopsie, I guess we're done with you. And so I knew what was happening.
She still worked. She was in, I've seen part of this, Tarzan and the Lost City, starring Casper Van Dien as Tarzan.
I don't need to know what that is to know that that is a fall from grace.
And she was in the remake of Clash of the Titans.
Oh, I saw that. I don't remember her. She is, what, some minor character, I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah.
At any rate, let's pretend we live in a world where we don't know that Richie is Jane March and just try to understand what they're telling us. That Richie is a teenager wearing headphones, strung out on drugs, or can only speak when he is on drugs. And he gets into a fight with this artist who's sitting in a giant baseball mitt. I mean, like, this movie is 10 tons of crazy and we're barely 10 minutes into this thing.
I mean, maybe Bob specializes in child therapy, and that's why there's a chair that's a giant baseball mitt.
It's glorious.
The furniture in here has me just questioning. But I think it's just Bob, because when we go to his house, he has a bed.
What is that bed? Yeah.
It was carved by Richie's older brother, and it has a giant lion head with a hook where I think you put your handcuffs during sex.
I thought that was a woman.
Yeah, no, I thought it was a woman with flowing long hair.
Yeah.
I thought it was a lion. We keep cutting to shots in this movie of lions that look like they're sticking their tongue out. There's just weird insert shots of lions with things coming out of their mouth. Maybe that was a woman, but...
No, I noticed lots of weird stuff. There's like all these optical illusion things, like this thing that where you look in it and you can see like 9 versions of yourself. Like, it just, someone was having fun with the set design.
Don't you get it? That means there's 9 different roses.
Yeah, no, I definitely got that. And again, this feels like Richard Rush. It feels like the Richard Rush that everyone called brilliant with the stuntman that I just went, huh? Like, it feels absurd in the same way, but I feel like this time the Emperor has been exposed as wearing no clothes. Like, everyone can see really early on, this shit is crazy.
But in this group, one person's performance made me lose them in the character. I did not recognize Brad Dourif as the OCD nerd.
It did take me a while to realize that that was Brad Dourif. I saw his name, and I always feel like he's so good and so handsome in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. I don't know why he wasn't a bigger star, but it's always fun to see him here, and he's kind of playing this nerdy, obsessive-compulsive guy. He's enjoyable.
Yeah, I mean, he's setting up something here because where he's introduced, because of his condition, he's counting books.
Yeah, so we know there's a book that's going to go missing and come back later on.
Right. They're setting up something with that, and he mentions the fact that, you know, he knows exactly how much the vacuum ashtray cost that they need because two of the guys in here, Bill and Casey, are smoking. Like, he's irritated.
His math is wrong because he's like, you can get it for $9.99. That's $4.99.5 for each of you. I'm like, wait, no, that's $4.98.5.
He's not a very good OCD.
Well, I do like that he says one could pay the extra penny, but I'm like, obsessive compulsive, you're going to take in tax. You're going to know exactly, you're going to Rain Man that and know the exact amount with LA and California tax.
But there's a lot of split diopter shots going on here. We get Willis in the foreground and whoever's talking in the background and try to get to know these characters. And I'll give it this, it's the right number of characters for a whodunit. And I am feeling like we are in a murder mystery. Yes, there's going to be some Hitchcockian influences in some of the attempts of movie making. I was thinking very much Agatha Christie, and I'm wondering, is this going to be Murder on the Orient Express, or are we going to be in 10 Little Indians?
It takes a while to kill Scott Bakula, frankly. They got to do a whole lot of, like, come to my house, chat up, let's go for a bike ride.
You got to go for that bike ride.
In the shorter cut, they kept the bike ride.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. Like, it took a really long time to get to his murder, almost 30 minutes, which you'd want 10 minutes out of that.
And there's a sad line where they're on this bike ride, and it's going to be a race, and Bill says to Bob, oh, let's make it 20 miles. And Bob's like, or we could just go back, whip out our dicks, see who's bigger, and have a nice breakfast. And Bruce goes, it won't be a nice breakfast, you'll be sulking.
I don't know, I saw that pool scene. I guess it's cold water.
I'll just say it now. They talked about replacing Bruce with a body double with a larger penis.
Oh, that's got to be a hit to the ego.
Yeah, wow, okay.
So then they promised Bruce no scenes he didn't approve would be in any cut of the movie, and he didn't approve any shots of Bruno.
So do they bring a fake one in anyway then?
No, that's, I mean, as far as I can tell, that's real. And the only time he talked about it was in a 1996 Playboy interview. And he's like, it's out there. It's on Laserdisc. What the fuck can I do now?
I get it. Some people are growers, not showers.
Yeah. But it's just funny that he says the I have the big dick line in the movie where he was almost replaced with a Dirk Diggler.
I'm more weirded out by the fact that, like, okay, so Scott Bakula doesn't know what happened in New York. It's front page news, but he has no idea that this colleague from back at Penn State Mental Health Institute is killing his patients.
I think he knows, but like a good therapist, he's letting Bill come to it when he's ready.
All right. Yeah, because they have this weird exchange. I'm wondering if it's expanded upon, in which Willis is basically saying there's this distinct absence of pain. Like, he doesn't feel anything about it, but he's crying into his beer. I'm wondering what the whole setup was and why we needed it. Again, if this is a murder mystery, why don't we just have Bruce Willis visiting Scott Bakula in L.A. and we don't have anything about he can't see the color red?
Stuart, I've watched the longer cut, and that's still my question. Why is there this whole opening where he can't see red and can't feel pain? None of it matters. It never comes back.
Okay.
It's supposed to be character-driven development where we're supposed to get the emotions Bill is feeling and his character arc through this external manifestation.
Yeah, I saw Vertigo. I know what the Vertigo means in terms of that movie's spiraling narrative. And yeah, you can do this better. It can still be melodramatic and weird and maybe not plausible, but at least thematically makes sense in that Hitchcock movie.
Again, I feel like a lot of times they're showing their hand very early when Bob is still alive. Bill asks him, why all this security? Oh, I'm getting these death threats. But he also mentions, like, yeah, I'm dating this woman. She just kind of drops by whenever she wants. I'm like, okay, so when a woman just happens to drop by, I know that's the killer.
And Andy says, you'll meet her. Doesn't he know at this point? Well, maybe not. I'm thinking he knows at this point Rose is Richie, because later on we're going to find he has a naked photo of Rose, and on the back he's written, it's in poetry, but basically, she's a sociopath who will kill you, is what he wrote on the back of this note.
Did he know Bonnie and Rose were the same person? I felt like he was psychoanalyzing Bonnie in those notes that he's going to hide with the Van Gogh cover.
If he knows all of this stuff, I don't know why he would bring his friend in, and I don't know why, yeah, he hasn't challenged Richie, but whatever, it's a great death scene. We got to admit, when he goes and gets stabbed 90 times in the back, I'm just cracking up.
Oh, it's that when he gets impaled by a piece of broken glass at the end. Like,
yes.
That's the final thing that does him off.
I didn't see it until the guy who was moderating the commentary said it. But this does have an Argento feel, doesn't it? Just the slashes and the way the blood goes and Bakula, just the extreme faces and all how bright the red blood is. I can see it now that somebody had said it. And immediately we're supposed to think Richie's the killer, right? Because
right. They're
wearing fingerless gloves.
Right, and the hoodie. If it's one of these patients, and I don't know why it has to be, but if it is one of these patients, the only one that they look like is Richie. But to be clear, this is none of the patients. It's actually the guardian character. You called him the brother, but Dale, in my cut, was described as someone that adopted Richie later.
No, he was the brother who became the guardian when the parents disappeared. And so he says, I've been his mother and his father, but I'm really his older brother.
Oh, that's your cut. I didn't know that. Okay.
That was in the shorter cut as somewhere.
My takeaway was the parents abandoned them as minors, and now that Dale is of age, he's trying to adopt them or something. I don't know.
In the shorter cut, if they mentioned what happened to the parents, I missed it, but they mentioned that Dale was the brother.
It just says they abandoned him.
All I'm saying is, if you are trying to get your brother in therapy out of therapy, why would you make the killer look more like him than anyone else in there? Why wouldn't you be framing Brad Dourif or Lance Hendrickson? Like, this seems like a bad way to go.
Now, there is an important scene here that is different in the director's cut than the theatrical cut. Because later on, you mentioned the missing books, and this is going to become important.
Okay.
Right before the home invasion, for reasons we don't know, Bob grabs a Van Gogh book and takes the book out of it and puts a different book in the slipcase. And he's being murdered in his office. So theoretically, the same room where he holds group, they fixed that window fast, but...
Yeah, no, I don't under... Again, I thought, okay, he's hiding this book with a slipcover for a Van Gogh art book. Someone's going to want to look at some Van Gogh art and discover it. No, I think Sandra just borrows it and then puts it back.
And she never looked in it.
Walk me back further. He is a therapist keeping notes on his patients. You should do that. Why is he hiding that at all?
He's hiding the one about Rose. And he's got in it the naked photo of Rose that says she's a sociopath and a scorpion.
Even though he's dating Rose. Or is he dating Bonnie and he doesn't know they're different people?
And he must not know that Richie is Rose.
Correct?
Good question marks after all our statements about this film.
Here's the thing is, later on in the director's cut, Dale says to Bill, if they became too familiar, he thought he, and I can't tell if he is referring to Bob or if he is referring to Casey, but that they would come to know Rose's face so well that they'd recognize Richie is Rose. So what I don't get is, how does Bob know somebody's trying to kill him? Have there been attempts? Have there been phone calls?
He said he's been getting death threats. So I assume phone calls or letters in the mail. I mean, we'll talk about a mailbox scene in a little bit.
Yeah, and there is later, there's a very strange subplot about a red sports car that's stalking Bob's car.
Okay, yeah, but I guess I would have liked to have had Bob mention some of that before this.
Oh, yeah.
But yes, I'm thinking now Dale killed Bob before Bob could realize Rose / Bonnie is Richie. And I also think Dale's a little jealous that his sister is sleeping with people other than him.
Right. We'll get to Dale when we get there. Let's first talk about Martinez, who, if this movie wasn't crazy enough already.
Worst cop ever.
Oh, my God. Like, introduced making racist comments about Eric LaSalle.
Yeah. Talk about defunding the police. Here we go.
Yeah. ER's Eric LaSalle shows up just to be a bit in his third world thing joke.
I saw Eric LaSalle in the opening credits, and I could not believe this was all he had in the regular cut. He gets scenes in the director's cut. He actually gets to speak.
He only shows up at the beginning in the theatrical one?
No, he shows up to bring coffee and get made the butt of this joke and never appears again.
What? He's not in at the end of the film?
No, not one bit.
Oh my gosh, you missed out on some of the best stuff.
Yeah, so seriously, I see Eric LaSalle deliver coffee to Bruce Willis in both cuts, but in the theatrical cut, you never see Eric LaSalle again.
Yeah, I was weirded out. But yeah, Martinez, like, this is, he's just warming up here. Like, I can't figure out whether he wants Bruce Willis to infiltrate this group or he's razzing him that he's doing it and accusing him of being the killer.
I think Martinez is getting him to do his work because he's a cop and he's got to play by the rules because he is breaking all kinds of laws here. And so I think he's using Willis to do all that.
At first, I think he thinks Bill is the murderer because he's from out of town. It's
right. You murdered your last patient is the kind of the way that he puts it.
And now he's staying in Bob's house. He's going to drive Bob's car. He can take over Bob's practice.
You can't do that, right? Like, if someone, your neighbor gets murdered, like, you can't live there. And certainly if the bills come.
Yeah, did Bob not have any heirs to, like, leave his stuff to? Is there no will?
It's very strange. And then he complains about having to pay utilities. I'm like, you got this house cheap.
Like, he doesn't have to pay the utilities. He's not living there. He doesn't own the house. Like, he could leave anytime.
I don't think he inherited anything. He just got the keys. When Bob died, he's like, here's car keys, here's house keys.
These are therapists. They have money. They have lawyers and wills. And, like, he's getting kicked out of here. Like, it's crazy.
It is weird.
And Bob mentions having an ex-wife. You gotta think she might be coming for some of this. But, yeah, I don't quite get Martinez's arc here. I think at the beginning he does think Bill is a suspect. He does come to the house to search it, and Bill does let him in without a warrant because, you know,
he's like, hey, don't you want to solve this murder of your friend?
Well, I mean, yes.
Yeah, sure, but you don't get to violate my constitutional rights to do it.
No, but you can allow a cop to search your house.
I don't think Bill can even say no because it's not his house.
All right, that is true. I think you don't need a warrant to search a dead man's residence.
But anyway, I mean, even more weird, he asked him, will you help me? And the next scene that they have in my cut, he's saying, why don't you shut this group down, and comparing it to a barracuda chewing on a penis or something?
Same as our cut.
Yeah, okay, all right. Like, that's, like, very contradictory in a way that I didn't know how to process.
If you stick your dick in with some barracudas once, you might pull it out okay. But if you leave it in with the barracudas, it's going to be gnawed off at the base.
Don't even try it once. Bad idea.
Yeah, I just, this guy should have his own show, right?
Like at one point they meet at a rock club?
Yeah, this was outside the Whiskey A Go-Go.
That is not in the theatrical cut.
Oh, wow. Because I was, so confused. Like, why are we at this location? Why are they meeting there? Did Martinez know Bill was going to be? Like, every scene just answers nothing and asks 100 more questions.
Admittedly, each scene in a movie should push the narrative and push the story along a little more, and does not.
But Bill is going to do it. Bill, I'm not exactly sure why. He, like, literally goes to the group and is just like, I'm even more fucked up than you are. I'm like, who wouldn't want this guy as their therapist? And he talks about his colorblindness, but okay, I'm going to do it. I'm going to lead this group in therapy and we'll see how this goes. Meanwhile, in walks, or I should say in crashes, Rose.
Well, even before Rose shows up, I think this is the first attempt on Bill's life. Like, he comes home from that rockin' nightclub, slips on water, and, like, the hose has been turned on. I guess that was a murder attempt.
Oh, is that what that was? I still don't know what that was.
I think. I don't know. I'm guessing.
I thought, you know, he's being pranked. Later, he'll have a rattlesnake in the mailbox, and so I just take it to mean there's a red sports car that will try to push another car atop him. Is this how you kill someone?
Yeah, how do you know when he's walking? When you're on top of a 7-story parking lot in a car, how do you know when someone's walking by for the perfect moment to push that car off? This movie.
And to be clear, this is a character we haven't even met yet, but this is all Dale doing all of this, from hoses to sports cars, while he's building furniture for giants.
You got it.
Okay, good. All right. So Rose, let's talk about Rose. Here she comes. She smashes into the back of him while he's on his way to doing the group therapy. And he doesn't even bother to ask for her information. He gives his address and then she shows up.
Yeah, the whole time she'll never give out her number, never give out her address. And again, which makes you automatically suspect of her. Like, you're automatically trying to figure out what her deal is because this is very weird behavior.
Well, she's the murderer, right? I mean, that's what you have to think is she shows up and she won't give you any information. She claims she's an uninsured driver and she claims she is off to an audition. And so she doesn't have time to stick around and talk to him, but will show up at his house later on. And I guess if she can't pay for the damage, she'll work it off.
Yeah, you cited it correctly earlier. I think the audience is to know that she is guilty. And so it's really, the whole thing is about, when will he wake up? We know that she's a danger, but because she's so hot, would you sleep with a serial killer? And how long would you let that affair go?
And that is the same thing as Basic Instinct, right there is the plot.
Right.
Exactly. They're definitely trying to emulate that dynamic. They go to some kind of, looks like a hotel, bar, restaurant or something, and then make out at a taxi cab stand. These early scenes are not very hot. I got to say, it's very confusing.
You're sounding like other scenes are hot.
Well, no, I mean, I definitely feel like the movie is going to, yeah, show you something in a bit. But you got to wait, what, in my cut, about an hour for anything really to happen between these two.
Oh, it's longer than that for us.
Oof.
Because there's more scenes here, but most of the stuff that happens, happens after that. But yeah, I mean, he takes over the group and then he meets Rose.
This is also the time, at least in the director's unrated cut, that you meet Dale.
Yes.
Because he comes to Bill and wants Richie out of therapy.
Yes. He believes that therapy makes Richie handicapped. And so it's cruel to make him do all of this. Admittedly, it's a terrible group for him. Like, he really should not be in this group, like, throwing people around in giant baseball mitts. But yeah, the idea is that Richie needs no therapy and just needs Dale. Do we suspect Dale at this point?
I didn't, because he's not in the group. We have been misled when Scott Bakula says he thinks someone in the group is trying to kill him.
Yeah, I just don't know enough about Dale at this point.
Yeah, I think when we finally see his massive warehouse where he makes the sculptures or whatever, that he makes a line about, like, he had to get Richie away from sexual abuse. That was where I started to be like, you know what? As fun as these psychotics are on Monday night, I think it's him. That's when I began to suspect.
And what's weird, again, I'm just looking at my notes and they sound like ravings of a madman. It's like, Richie's brother wants him out of therapy. My next note, Casey tied up while being whipped. Is this Dale that was whipping him off screen? Or was Casey with Rose/Bonnie and she was whipping him because Casey's going to be painting her?
All right, yeah, I have the question about that because we're told in one of the group sessions, they decide to talk about sex. This comes much earlier in the theatrical cut, and it's almost one of the last scenes in the director's cut.
Oh, okay. Yeah. It's about 57 minutes in. I love, yeah. Like, all right, I'll take over the group. Tell me about your sex life.
Yeah, in the theatrical cut, it is like almost at the climax.
Wow.
There's a lot rearranged. Trying to take notes on two versions of this and keep them straight, what was new and what was just rearranged, that looks like a crazy person too. So during this sex conversation, everybody reveals they're like in love with this gorgeous woman. We got Buck, who's a widowed man who is dating her, but thinks she won't sleep with him until they're married. Did I get that right?
I did not get that. I got the sense that he didn't think he could love again because his wife and daughter died. And that's his big mystery that we have to find out about him, that they were killed in a drive-by and he still keeps the car around.
Yeah, I don't know why we need to find that out.
There is so much more of that in the director's cut.
Oh, okay.
Oh, do you not get all the Martinez stuff?
Martinez and Buck both worked in narcotics together.
They were like partners.
And Martinez was screwing Buck's wife.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Of course he was.
And so when Buck's wife and children get killed, both Buck and Martinez are suspects. This is all dropped to us from Eric LaSalle, by the way.
Oh, okay. Well, let's see. I had no Eric LaSalle to explain any of this. And I don't think I want him, frankly. This just sounds unnecessary. A red herring too many.
And it comes very late in the director's cut, so I don't even believe it at that point.
Yeah, it is really strange. But it's worse in the theatrical cut, because literally at the climax, at the end station, Bruce Willis is running around dodging a gun being shot at him, screaming, "Martinez, why didn't you tell me Buck was a cop?" Like, that matters at that moment.
I was so confused by that.
And that was a line that was cut and pasted from earlier in the group therapy session, where it all comes out that Martinez and Buck are now friends, because Buck was like, "I couldn't forgive my wife because I didn't have time, so I decided to forgive Martinez."
And see, I thought, like, this is Willis, again, bad at his job. You don't know what your patient's occupations are? Like, can't you open the file? Read at the top. It probably says right there, cop.
Yeah, again, if you have someone going to therapy and they're like, "Yeah, I need therapy, but I'm not going to talk about anything about my life," I don't know why they're paying for therapy. I don't know why you're putting up with that as a therapist. I don't know. Maybe that's what you do. And you just let them come out and tell their story in their own time. But it doesn't seem like a great way to spend your money on therapy if you're just going to refuse to talk and tell anything.
Yeah, then we got Sandra, who can't wait to talk about sex. That's her defining. I guess she's also a kleptomaniac. But what comes through here is that she's got the eyes for Willis.
We never really see her steal much. There's one scene in group where she grabs a gold lighter from one of the smoking guys, but then gives it back.
She's going to steal that book of Bob's with all the notes about Bonnie.
But she thinks she's stealing a Van Gogh book, and she never opens it.
I think she opened it, but she saw what it was and just was very kind-hearted and didn't read it.
I assume when we have that scene of her in the shopping spree with her female lover, that was all stolen gear.
Maybe, but there were a couple of times where it looked like she was trying to steal from Bonnie, but then decided she couldn't steal from this woman she loves so much.
Oh, wow. So there's a lot of her and Bonnie. Here in my cut, it basically is mentioned that she's dating a woman, but she'd rather be with a man.
No, I think they have a kiss at one point, and yeah, they go shopping together, and Bill almost catches them together.
In the theatrical cut is the scene where Bill almost catches them together, and it's much earlier in the film again, where you see Bonnie and Sandra are together and going to spend the day together, but this is when Bill decides to make one of his Are You a Murderer house calls.
Yes. And then, like, the personal trainer shows up. I mean, where's the pizza boy? Like, this feels like a porno with the scenes cut out. Not enough sex, again, is what I'm saying, the problem with this cut.
But you have to know, I mean, is it hard to recognize that Bonnie is Rose at this point? Because
no.
In the director's cut, we're going to get a major reveal moment.
Oh, the fact that she's a redhead with red lipstick and a red dress. Like, just in case you didn't know, they're going to show us that Bonnie and Rose have the same tattoo, but I didn't even know that. And if Bill can't see red, again, he should see Bonnie and go, oh, that's Rose, and that's what should crack the case.
Yeah, but we do get one scene with the two of them where Bonnie seems mad because they were supposed to spend the day together, even though the personal trainer comes literally 5 minutes later.
And maybe it was going to be a three-way. I don't, again, who knows with Sandra? She's into a lot of things. We'll find out she's ended up dating Clark as well.
And she tried to stab Clark and Bonnie. When Bill makes his Are You the Murderer house call to Clark, he figures out that Clark and Sandra were screwing. And then Clark pulls a dress out of his dresser and holds it up. And there's two big slashes. And he says, Sandra did this to me, and then he tried to do this to my girlfriend. I'm guessing Clark slashed them down the back, but later we're going to see Dale gave those identical cuts to Rose, and the reason I remember is they kind of look like in X3 when Angel cuts his wings off. I mean, those are where those cuts are.
I don't even understand why they're cut that way.
It's like self-flagellation. Like if you took a whip and whipped your own back, you know, they used to do that as penance.
But this is Dale doing it to them.
Yeah. I've read the Da Vinci Code. I know about that self-flagellation religious stuff, but this is Dale cutting them in a certain way. But at certain points when I was thinking about this movie, I feel like Rose has to be attacking somebody, right? But we're supposed to think it's all Dale, and that doesn't make sense.
See, I thought the killer was going to be Rose.
Yeah, my feeling was that some of this activity was happening by Rose because she has multiple personalities and is not, therefore, accountable for some of the things that she does. That she has sought out each member in this group and is capable of doing some of this behavior when she's with that one individual.
But she's Bonnie with all of them, and I have to think there's only one Bonnie. So Bonnie knows that Bonnie is screwing everybody in group. Does Rose know she's Bonnie? And why is Rose showing up for so much sex with Bruce Willis? And I will say, Maxim doesn't have it wrong. The sex scenes are really, really steamy. When Jane Marsh was hired, she knew what movie she was hired for. She knew that there was going to be a lot of nudity, and based off her previous film, that was supposedly okay. It was in her contract. When the time came, she was as nervous as Bruno. She refused to do it. She was not going to be naked in this film.
Huh. Did my eyes deceive me?
Richard Rush described it as he felt like he was verbally raping the actress because he had to berate her and remind her of the contract and force her to do all these scenes.
So it is her. Okay. Against her will, to some degree.
Yeah.
What a fun movie this is.
Yeah, boy, if you were feeling bad about the sex already with all this brother-sister interaction, eek.
It feels very bizarre, and you know a lot of times in a movie that they're going to cut away, and you'll see like a train go in a tunnel, and we get it. We get the innuendo there.
Yeah, Hitchcock did that one, yeah.
So can you explain what the innuendo is here during this whole pool fucking scene? They cut to people hang gliding? I don't know. Did I miss a reference? Did I miss some kind of sexual experience? What does hang gliding have to do with sex?
They didn't do that in my cut.
I thought it was, they felt like they were flying. But the sex in Stewart's cut just continues. I mean, they're screwing in the pool. They're screwing in the bed. Then they're screwing in the shower. In the director's cut, it stops because Rose says she wants to have a fancy meal, makes Bruce Willis get dressed up in a suit. She shows up fully naked, sits down, they don't eat the food, and then she strips him and takes him to the shower. I'm like, what fucking game is this?
Yeah, what was the point of that? What did Rush have to say about all this? Why is this the superior cut? None of this makes sense.
And it sounds like a knockoff of 9½ Weeks that has a very famous sex scene in front of the refrigerator.
You know, this is just why I'm not into S&M or furry stuff. How much time did he spend picking out the suit, making sure it was all buttoned? It takes a while for a man to put on a suit, like 10 minutes. I do not want to spend 10 minutes putting on some fucking getup just for sex.
I mean, he's got to wait while she cooks a steak and makes a salad too, and then they don't eat anything.
And Rush said that steak was intentionally a sexual thing. How is the steak sexual? I watched that scene 4 times.
I didn't get anything sexual off of it.
Didn't see it once.
It was supposed to look like a vagina? Or it was raw because he can't see red? I don't know.
That would have been great if that's how she tried to kill him, by feeding him raw meat that he couldn't detect.
I want to point out there is a plot thing that's going on amid all of this sex. They do feature an extended sequence, even in my tamer cut, in which Bruce Willis is eating her out in the pool. This is when we know, even if we think that she is Richie, she doesn't have a penis, right? This is when we know that the real person must be Rose, and that Richie is an act of this actress.
But I didn't realize the first time I watched it that this was Richie. It wasn't until after we first met Rose and then went back to group, which was post-sex, that I saw Richie again and I went, oh, that's that actress. But yes, this is not a crying game. The crying game would have come out a couple years before this. And if you're wondering if that's what the twist is going to be here, no, this is all woman and you're going to see that quite a few times.
Over and over.
In the extended cut, there's a scene where Martinez and Bill are looking through Bob's photo albums and find a naked photo of Bob's ex-wife, and Martinez goes, nice bush.
Yeah, Martinez is all kind of like his birthday party with the helicopter mooning flyby, all of that.
Yeah, a female cop gets out there and like, that's very dangerous, just to moon everyone.
Yeah, what a birthday. So help me out here.
I don't know that I can.
I can't, Stuart. I'm already going to say that.
I know. I understand. There's a lot going on and they have not threaded the needle here. So we have a lot of suspects, but there's no real reason to conclude it's anyone other than Rose, right? Like, that's what's so bizarre.
Yeah, the reason I never connected her with Richie, I thought that was a red herring that, oh, it really is someone with gender identity issues, and it's really Rose slash Bonnie that's been killing everyone, because we're going to find out she's dating everyone, and I thought that was just, you know, just happened to infiltrate this group for reasons we'll maybe find out in the end, because this movie doesn't like to give reasons for stuff.
I'd also just throw out, maybe because I was tying into Vertigo so quickly, Vertigo has a twist that I won't fully spoil, but it is about two women that look alike. And so they do a similar kind of reveal without it being a gender flip.
But I could so easily tell that Bonnie was Rose. But in the extended cut, there's a second scene between Sandra and Bonnie. And this scene, to me, feels like Rush thinks it's really important. I'm not quite sure that it is. The two of them are coming back from a day of shopping or stealing or whatever it is they do. And across the way, Sandra's neighbors are about to have sex on the kitchen table. And so they peek and watch and get turned on and start smacking each other's asses. And I get the impression from this movie that Sandra has not had sex with Bonnie, because there is one scene earlier on where Sandra says, "You look at me like a man, and it's different with men." And Bonnie slash Rose says, "Well, it doesn't have to be." So here, when they're watching these people fuck across the window, you see Sandra's finally ready. She kisses Bonnie and pulls up her skirt, and we see a rose tattoo. And then she says, "Take this off. You're so much prettier without it," and removes Bonnie's wig. I think this is supposed to have us all go, "Oh! That's really Rose!"
Right, right. Because, yeah, that would be telling you if you hadn't figured it out. Because in the pool scene, it's very, very clear. We see on Jane March's ass, and she's Rose at that point, that she has that Rose tattoo.
And I just want to say it again. It's been said many times, but no, if this is going to shock you, it should be because Bill figures out Rose and Bonnie are the same person because he's colorblind. Like, ugh.
Yeah, I know.
And then comes the biggest twist of the whole movie. Rose slash Bonnie says to Sandra, "I can't sleep with you because I've met someone and I love him." And I guess she's breaking up with everyone, because Clark's going to say in the next group therapy session that his girlfriend called and no reason, they're just broken up.
Oh, okay. That actually, I mean, it's awful and it's stupid and it's ridiculous, but that at least explains something about the end when we find out that Bill is important to her in ways that allow her to have a new personality.
Yeah, so this is telling us, A, Bonnie is Rose. You know, if you didn't figure out that Bonnie slash Rose is Richie, I'm not going to hold anything against you. You just may not have seen just one of the guys as many times as I have.
Very true.
I think it's pretty obvious, but yeah, I mean, you know, the movie's confusing.
But if you didn't know Bonnie was Rose and you needed this moment as a big reveal, how close attention are you really paying?
To be fair, you could pay very close attention to this film and miss a lot of stuff.
And I would just say, in my cut, Bonnie is barely in it. The Bonnie character doesn't get a lot of screen time.
And then shortly after this scene, in both cuts, we're going to find out that Casey, the artist...
Wait. Yeah, we see his art here? What gallery is putting up pictures of women with spikes coming out of their ass?
Well, first of all, I think Clive Barker made a career of it.
Yes.
Okay, I don't think Casey's Clive Barker. I haven't seen a Hellraiser that he's put out.
I think if they can do an exhibition on Candyman, they could do this.
But second, he doesn't even need to show it. It is a dropped line when Bill is using his psychic powers to deduct everything that wasn't said in the group. Casey is the son of rich people who are paying for his loft and paying for his art supplies. He's a trust fund baby. He doesn't have to sell any of that art. He's just got it made.
I mean, he is kind of talented, like, despite the composition, like, he's got good technique.
He's also a weightlifter, I think.
No, he just has workout gear. I mean, he has a big loft, so he has a lot of space.
And we got to see it a couple of times in the director's cut. We only see it once in the theatrical cut, but he's working out, and Bill is about to do his "Are You the Murderer?" house call. And while Bill is leaving the voicemail that says, "I'll be there in 30 minutes, somebody puts a belt around Casey's neck. And Casey knows this person and goes, "Oh, what are you doing here?" And then, like, "Can I take the call?" And then the belt gets tighter. He thinks this is sex play. And then he's going to be murdered. There's two important differences in the director's cut and the theatrical cut on this Casey death. First, in the theatrical cut, when Casey doesn't answer the door, Bill climbs up the fire escape, lets himself in, sees some stuff on fire, and then Casey's body comes hanging upside down like a piece of meat.
Yeah, there's also a cow on the roof, and I couldn't figure that one out, but yes.
Can't either. But in the director's cut, while Bill is knocking on the door, we get a shot of Casey tied up and still very much alive. So while Bill was climbing the fire escape, the killer killed Casey and hung him upside down. Take that for what you will.
A fresher kill.
Bill pulls a rope and all the art with the cutout faces starts sliding because that's some Goldbergian shit artists need.
Mm-hmm.
And Casey's body comes and Bill puts his fingers down on the ground and pulls something up, and it's like clay.
It's blood, right? He can't see the color, though, so it looks gray.
Yeah, in the director's cut, this is when he becomes able to see color again. The gray turns red.
Oh, I didn't notice that. I thought that all happened at the end. I didn't realize that's when he's starting to see color again. He's feeling emotion again.
Yeah, I don't know why Casey's death is the one, but when I'm watching this, I'm not putting together, because it's not like they've desaturated red through this whole movie. It's not like the anti-Schindler's List, where you have all color except red. That would be really amazing to sell that hard in this film. But we've seen red before. So when you're in an artist's loft and I see Bill putting his fingers into something gray, I'm like, is it paint? Is it clay? I didn't get it was blood until I saw the director's cut, where all of a sudden it all turns red. And it's the exact inverse effect that we saw at the beginning. So now Bill can see.
See, I didn't take it as Bill being able to see. I just took it as the director putting a fine point that this is blood. See, audience, it's red. I didn't know Bill was seeing that red as well.
If he isn't, then they shouldn't have used that same effect.
But then you would have thought it was paint the whole time or something else.
Which I did in the theatrical cut.
So you need to show that red color.
Not that his color blindness ever is mentioned again.
And this is Dale, not Bonnie, that kills him?
Does this mean Casey is bisexual and been having S&M relations with Dale?
Yeah, why was he having a relationship with... If Dale's just going around killing everyone for hooking up with his sister, okay, I get it, but... Yeah, it feels like there's something consensual going on between Dale and Casey.
I would not rule out the possibility that Rose slash Bonnie is having her own killings or her own homicidal role play.
Yeah, because we'll find out there's a fire going on when Bill finally gets there and someone has cut the faces off the paintings. And of course, we'll see one and it's Bonnie. He's been painting Bonnie. He's been seeing Bonnie.
But that was Dale. Dale did it so nobody could see it's his sister.
Which is weird. I would have bought it if Dale just walked in and killed him. But because he seems to know Casey and they seem to be cool doing whatever they're doing, it's muddy. Like everything in this film. I can't see red because there is mud over everything.
Let's just cut to the chase. In a sex thriller like this in the 90s, you want to traffic in homosexual themes because that's edgy and people didn't like to talk about it in public, and you introduced it in a movie and it felt like it was really provocative. So yeah, they're testing the waters here, but they back away because, you know, this is a tame R-rated movie in my cut.
I mean, I know it's a whodunit and we can't see the killer, but man, something needed to be made more clear about this. Because if Rose has a murderous personality, I think we could all forgive that. That wouldn't make her somebody who has to go away forever at the end and can't be with Bill. But this is the one point of the movie on four watchings that I still am like, who the fuck did that?
Yeah, maybe this Dale character can puppet her around. Again, I'm not even sure how he's managed to convince her to play the dead brother. Like, none of this, once the bombshells start dropping here, we'll find out in quick succession that Bruce Willis is going to go back to the therapy group, find that journal. That's when they all realize they've been sleeping with the same suspect. And then bombshell number two, the old therapist of Richie, the widow, will say, my husband is dead because Richie killed himself. And so, surprise, there is no real Richie. There's only a sister named Rose. But we're to know that Dale is connected to all these people? Again, I thought he was the guardian. I thought he had no bloodline to those two.
Now, they mentioned brother. I mean...
Yeah, they said brother, at least in the director's unrated cut.
They say so much, though. And, you know, we say this all the time. We get called out on some reviews because a listener's like, why didn't you get that? They said it right here, and he can point to the script. Show, don't tell. We needed to see some scenes of Dale picking Richie up from therapy or something. You know, it was very weird to me when we see Bill talking to Dale out of nowhere and Dale is trying to get Richie out of therapy.
Or some kind of line from Bob before he dies. Oh yeah, this Richie guy, his brother's always trying to get him out of therapy. He doesn't like him in therapy. Like, something to set this up. It's just totally out of the blue.
Well, here's the thing, though. I just want to say that most of this is designed to titillate, right? Most of this is to make people go, ooh, this is interesting, kinky, maybe a little transgressive here. But once you get into the idea of siblings raping each other and all, like, that really, like, goes sour in a way that, like, my boner is gone, right? Like, this is bad.
Don't tell that to Pornhub, because it has suggested some shit I never want to see.
Oh, yeah, step-sibling porn's the big thing.
And again, I'm not trying to judge that, but I do feel like for mainstream America, they are trafficking in two different kind of scenarios. One, a salacious fantasy, and then one, a really depraved flowers in the attic kind of thing that...
Yeah, because here's the thing. Richie killed himself because he's getting molested by that other therapist, but he was also getting raped by his brother?
Yes.
But that wouldn't have made him kill himself.
Yes, it did.
No, they say the therapist raping him is what made him kill himself.
But that's because they didn't know Dale was doing it. And the therapist who molested Richie is dead. Did Dale kill him?
Yeah. I mean, again, who even wants to go near this close enough to find out? It's just so gross. It's just so depraved. It's like, ooh, let's just... Moving on, I thought this was going to be kinky fun.
It makes Rose's horniness less sexy.
Yes.
Sadly, this is true. People who are molested often become hypersexual as adults.
I don't know if you ever listened to Loveline, but yeah, whenever they had a porn star on there, they're like, okay, what age were you molested? And they always, yes, they always had an answer to that. There was some age they were touched.
I used to watch Loveline when it was on MTV. It's in Tracy Lord's autobiography I read. I mean, but it is just a psychological fact that can happen. So now I view all of these sex scenes with Bruce Willis as kind of sad. Still kind of hot, but kind of sad.
Yeah. And it gets sadder still when we get to this climax and he goes to this warehouse, pulling the wig and the glasses off. Is this a shocker for anyone? Has anyone not known? I mean, I just wanted to stand up and scream, I know who killed me. Like, we've gone that crazy.
It did remind me of that movie. You know, the first so bad it's good movie that we ever reviewed. And here we are back to it, it felt.
Yeah, that same feeling of just depraved, like half of it is just, ooh, so gross and seedy. And then the other half is just outrageous camp.
Yeah, the fact that this final shootout's going to be with a nail gun. Like, Martinez is going to show up again. He can't do anything because his hands get nailed to the wall.
All right, I had to look this up. I remember in Lethal Weapon 2, we discussed the possibility of using a nail gun as a weapon. And back in the 90s, you could use a nail gun as a projectile weapon, but it had shit for accuracy. You would not be able to shoot the web of somebody's hand or later on shoot somebody in the forehead. It's not sharpshooting. It's more like you're scattering bullets at a person just so you can get away and stop them. And in 2011, OSHA banned that type of nail gun. Now you can only buy the nail guns that you push against the wood and then they fire. You can no longer buy the I shoot nails at you type of nail gun.
Regardless, why did they choose this as the weapon, as the climax? Again, I feel like...
Because she kept getting nailed.
Ugh, yeah, maybe.
No, you gotta go with some kind of religious imagery. Crucifixion. Again, Martinez getting nails through the palms of his hands, but I can't see a through line for anything here.
This movie's too deep for me, because this climax is taking place at Paradox Iron Mill. Paradox.
Is that what they call it?
What is the paradox? Stunned silence among the crowd.
I can't even come up with a good joke because it's this movie's so bizarre. Stuart, I gotta ask you. I mean, you get this whole shootout with the nail gun, and then Rose, what does she do? She climbs up on some tower where she's gonna jump off and kill herself?
Yeah, because we gotta bring him back to the beginning. Again, it's all like Vertigo. Like, he just keeps reliving that. I mean, she didn't put lipstick on, or maybe she did. How would he know? He can't see red. But yeah, she's going to jump off the building, and he's gotta stop his patient. I guess it's his patient. It's both his patient and his lover, so there's been a lot of laws broken.
And so he saves the girl, and guys, there's a red light flashing on that tower that they're on, and he could see it now.
Yeah, sure, all furniture stores have them, don't you know?
Yes.
It's a red furniture light.
again, my question for you, Stuart, you watched this theatrical cut. Do you just have Martinez making jokes like, hey, guys, get down here and free me? Like the entire film, like there is a end credit scene of Martinez doing voiceover asking to be free. Like, why is it a comedic ending?
You know, we got to love Martinez. Again, he's racist. He's terrible at his job. Apparently screws other people's wives. Like, he should deserve his own series.
So this was the theatrical ending with Martinez just like talking over this supposedly romantic ending.
Yes.
Yeah. You fucking daffodils, get down here with some band-aids is the last line. And this didn't win Woo! Best script. I don't know. I should have won best song. I gotta say, this Celine-infused cheese that they got here on the end, that's actually when I laughed. For much of this movie, I was just kind of dumbstruck. But when the song kicked in and the credits kick in, that's like just giving me permission to let the dam break. And I just fucking rolled for like 6 minutes.
It's like a good therapy session. You finally had that breakthrough. The emotions have come through. You're seeing red again.
Is he? I mean, I'm confused.
Yeah, that's why they focus on that light flashing, because he's like looking at it. He could see it. I don't know, like, it would have been cool if that red thing mattered, I guess.
I'm surprised the end song wasn't Warrant, I Saw Red.
They couldn't afford it.
They had quite a bit of money for this movie. It had a $40 million budget. Mm. Although, according to the director, it only spent $33 million and the producers just pocketed $7 million so they could be sure that they had some profit.
I ain't even gonna hate on you. Normally that's a cheap trick, but I'm like, yeah, grab, just rob the till. Just rob the money and get out. Because this is not worth, yeah, nope. And definitely put Alan Smithy's name on it.
So Jacob Stewart, what color is your arrow for the color of night? Jacob.
You know, I realized after seeing this, the greatest twist that M. Night has ever pulled is convincing us, maybe not you, Stuart, but convincing most of America that Bruce Willis could play a credible therapist. Because now I have seen The Color of Night, and oh boy, I can't believe he ever took another role where he'd play that same occupation.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, this is such a baffling film. That snake in the mailbox scene, that just the bicycle riding scene, that so much of it, it's just baffling. Like, I wasn't laughing. I just had my mouth agape.
Yes.
Like, trying to figure out this puzzle. Like, this is a Rubik's Cube. No one can figure out a Rubik's Cube. I know there's people that know the algorithm to do it, but most people, again, normal people.
I have a coworker who can do it, and I fucking hate that.
Yeah, well, show him this movie and see if he could figure it out, because no normal person can. We need some kind of Tony Stark genius to come in and really parse this film out. This film is crazy. I think you've gotten the sense of that as we've talked about it.
And if you didn't understand what the hell we were saying, neither did we.
Yeah, that is part of the experience. And so The Color of Night, it's not red. It's more like the color of shit. This is brown. This is a Brown Arrow movie. Like, it is, whew. I don't know if you're going to get turned on by it and it's going to be hot, but it's going to entertain you. It's not good, but yeah, Brown Arrow territory all the way.
Stuart.
Yeah, colorblind or not, it's easy to see the red faces on everyone involved in the making of this stunningly pretentious attempt to bend Hitchcock into Kama Sutra positions. I most feel sorry for Jane March, who again was going to be the it girl who had done this precious art movie and saw all of that cachet run right through the window, splatter into a gray-red mess. The second she appears in Wretchy Drag, it's over for her. Her life is just over. And the performance belongs in the bad movie pantheon alongside Elizabeth Berkley in Showgirls, Madonna in Body of Evidence, and Lindsay Lohan in I Know Who Killed Me. It's that good. I warn you. As I've already said, Color of Night may not play start to finish like a laugh riot. You may not find the whole thing funny. It's a slow burn. I had that delayed response where it took me most of the movie to even get in touch with my emotions. I guess I'm like Bruce Willis in it. It's so bizarre it impaired my laugh reflex. It's just a weird-ass movie. But you will eventually laugh. And I think the person that laughs hardest is Jeff Fahey. Yes, the Lawnmower Man actor spent the entire 1990s slumming in pathetic Skinamax thrillers, Blind Heat, Extramarital, The Sketch Artist. I'm sure he would have been happy to throw a few of those scripts Bruce's way if he could get on the A-list. He's like, I'll do Die Hard with a Vengeance, and you can do Hard Vengeance. How about that? But Congratulations, Bruno. This is something more embarrassing than your music career on your resume. I gotta strongly disagree with that therapist from the opening. To deny red does not deny emotion. It's Brown Arrow is all that I can say here. I'm just so happy watching Color of Night.
You know, in the commentary, Rush said, and I don't know if he's speaking metaphorically or literally, but he said that he tried to structure every scene of this movie like a joke. And the scene would build and build, and then the last line of the scene would be the punchline. And he wanted it to be funny in certain ways.
Oh, okay.
He complained that in the theatrical cut, they cut the punchline of every joke. Every single scene was trimmed. And they trimmed what he considered the punchline that emphasized the point of the scene and moved the story forward.
Hmm. Intriguing idea. Is that, do you guys find that to be true?
No! You've heard us talk about this film, Stuart. How could you ask that?
Well, I know, but I mean, when you hear something like that, it makes me want to watch this movie all over again. I want to see this longer cut.
The thing is, I think Rush was playing some of this for humor. Because behind some of the most depressing scenes, did you guys notice they're playing like carnival music and like Benny Hill type score?
Mm-mm. Is that in my cut?
It is. I definitely noticed it in yours. In the director's cut, because they only had 2 weeks to cut it, the sound mix is actually really awful and the music's very, very loud in places.
Yeah, no, when you get to all these sex scenes, I don't think it's like steamy music that's accompanying it. Everything feels off.
No, but it's specifically, I think anything with Clark or Casey, I hear this music box carnival stuff.
Yeah, you get into sitcom level.
Yes, exactly. So is this the world's most subversive, misunderstood comedy?
I mean, I laughed.
Again, you might have the same impression watching The Stuntman. I felt like it was a stunt pulled on the audience. Like, it felt ridiculous.
Well, they're going for Hitchcock. I refer to this film as Hitchcock-a-mamie bullshit.
I mean, it's got some cock in it.
In two cuts. Much to Bruce's chagrin, too. And in that Playboy interview, it was brought up to Bruce, you know, Sharon Stone said that she didn't know Paul Verhoeven was going to show her vagina in that scene. Bruce Willis's response was, yeah, but that movie made $250 million. Mine was a flop.
Is he talking about his dick or the movie?
It sounds like he's equating both.
But yeah, this movie, I am strangely fascinated with it now that I know as much as I do about it. And the fourth time I watched it, my wife came in and she started laughing with me at it. So this can only be a Brown Arrow, which means this movie gets 3 recommends on our website.
Of course it does. I found it would. I honestly did. Watching this movie, I'm like, we've all got to rally around this. We can't always agree, but on Color of Night, everyone...
I mean, from the opening scene alone, like, I'm like, oh, okay, this is going to be Brown Arrow. I get it.
It really was.
Apparently, the Color of Night is shit brown.
Yeah.
Yes.
But there's a sad ending to all of this. So, when the movie did come out, in the trades, apparently, now, this is according to Rush... Vanya hired the biggest PR firm in California to publish articles saying that this was all Rush's fault, that Rush was not working with the studio, that he was going rogue, and it is this PR that is why he has never worked again, is they published this in the trades, and he says they were smart, they published it in the trades on Friday, so he wasn't even able to get a rebuttal out until Monday. And he was at home that weekend writing his rebuttals to go in all the trades about why this film wasn't his fault and that it wasn't his final cut when he had a heart attack.
Oh, this is the near-death experience you talked about.
He was hospitalized and found out final cut is actually when they give you open heart surgery.
Ba-dum-tsh.
That's his line.
Yeah, you know what? I'll laugh. He deserves that much. And I take it he lived, right?
I mean, he did the commentary and told about it. So yes, he lived.
We were permitted to laugh because it didn't end in tragedy. It was just a minor setback on a shoot that sounds way out of control.
But it helped him get perspective, and he realized he can't win a PR battle from a hospital bed. So this movie did kill his career and almost killed him. But I think, you know, for some directors, this could be a crowning jewel. You have to be good to make a movie this bad.
Yeah, again, Oscar nominated the last movie he made, Razzie winner of this movie, and well deserved.
I mean, both award winners. What can you say? The guy's consistent.
And the Maxim Award. Do not discount the Maxim Award.
This guy's got quite the trophies on his fireplace mantle.
Well, we're not done with this kind of crazy thrillers. We're starting the Sleepaway Camp series starting next Friday. If you're a platinum donor, you will be getting into, I believe, 5 of those movies. I've only seen the first.
I haven't seen any. I'm a total newbie.
I can't wait to hear what you think.
Yeah, it's not Friday the 13th. I think it's safe to say that if you like Jason, you may or may not like Angela. Not guaranteed.
Well, we'll find out that on next Friday. Until then, thank you to Olay for your support, for picking this movie. I mean, in the end, I had a great time talking about it with you guys. I hope you, for donating, also had a great time. And Jacob Stewart, thank you for joining me. But what I really need now is normalcy.
All right. So much for the famous fucking Monday group.
Thank you to all the listeners who have backed us through our Podbean crowdfunding campaign. And we hope you've enjoyed this special bonus movie review podcast.
One minute you have friends, the next moment they've slipped away.
Without patrons such as yourself, we couldn't keep doing the shows we put out every single Tuesday. So thanks to you all.
But the truth is, you are the people that make this work.
And a special thanks to Orle Horvy for his support and for picking Color of Night for our host to review. If you enjoy Now Playing, please head to iTunes and leave us a 5-star listing. It's the best way to help spread the word about the podcast.
Funny. Oh, fucking laugh. We're entertaining the shit out of you, aren't we?
You can follow Now Playing on Facebook and Twitter, where we post announcements of new episodes and where the hosts post movie mini reviews. Links to our social media pages are available on our homepage.
I open my mouth to talk, but nothing happens.
Now Playing Podcast is produced by Arnie Carvalho.
He loves the suffering.
Associate produced by Jason Latham.
Because I really can't handle that right now.
Sure you can. Come on.
Now Playing is edited by Steven and Arnie.
Everybody's having fun but me, goddammit.
Now Playing credits read by Brock.
I'm glad to hear you like it.
Very much.
The opinions expressed on Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated.
I know what kind of force group can become in your lives. You tell things here, intimate things that you wouldn't tell your best friend.
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with the motion pictures reviewed or otherwise referred to herein.
I know that I've got something broken, and I know that it's going to take some time to get it fixed.
All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review and no infringement is intended.
I know it's against the law and everything. Don't buzz my chops.
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of Venganza Media Incorporated and may not be used without the expressed written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
You want a lawyer?
Do I need a lawyer?
You're in LA. Everybody needs a lawyer.
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2020. And no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
Is this what you call treatment failure?
Well, it's not a total loss. That's without counting everything.
They say, we got this script, Color of Money. Bruce Willis is already attached.
Nope.
Color of Money. Oh, shit. It's my notes actually say Color of Money.
It's going to happen a lot. We just watched the thing.
Clark is going to be murdered. Now, it's
in, what?
It's inferred that Clark is into S&M.
Wait, are you talking about Casey?
Oh, Casey.
Yeah, Casey.
Yeah, I was like, did Clark die? Brad Dourif?
And he's into S&M.
That I could blame.
I mean, in the end, I had a great time talking about it with you guys. I hope you, for donating, also had a great time. Looking for a line.
Till next week, don't fuck your sister or brother.
And if you do, put it on Pornhub, because apparently it's big.
It's step siblings. That's how they get around. It's actually, even parody incest porn is against the law.
Oh, my
God. So that's why it's step siblings.